From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're keeping an eye on Hurricane Dorian, whose eye is now about 60 to 100 miles off the coast of Florida, the outer bands lashing coastal waters. But it's also continuing to snail-like crawl across the Bahamas with devastating impacts. At least 5 people have now died there. Eugene Duffy is managing editor of the Tribune, the daily national newspaper of the Bahamas. He's based in Nassau. Eugene, we're reminded that the Bahamas are actually 700 islands. It's been so difficult to reach people further out. Give us a sense of what's going on with this storm so stuck.
The thing to remember about the Bahamas is we're the length of California. Where I am in the capital, Nassau, we're about 150 miles south of where Dorian hit on Sunday. In Nassau, we're suffering 40, 50-mile-an-hour winds. We've been without power across most of the island here since yesterday. But this is nothing compared with what has been going on in the islands of Abaco, Grand Bahama, islands with populations totaling 75,000 people. There's no power. A lot of houses have been flooded out to the level of the upper bedroom windows. There are thousands of people literally wandering around in waist-high water, looking for shelter, looking to get to higher ground, which for a lot of these islands isn't there.
Well, this is where the 5 deaths were reported, the Abaco Islands. And, you know, you mentioned water up to the windows, water up to the attics. I mean, people are calling it the Katrina of the Bahamas. And we remember one of the most prominent things. People were forced up into their attics by water and then a horror. They couldn't get out. Now people have axes in their attics. But is that what you're fearing is happening in parts of the Bahamas?
Well, looking at this here, it reminds me more of the tsunami in Japan, where the water literally has just rolled over these islands. There were public shelters set up, hurricane centers for people to go to. Unfortunately, as you see in the States, a lot of time the government says, get out, there's a hurricane coming, and people choose to remain behind. The hunt now is to see, are there any more victims of this? I mean, there's been so little access because there's no phone lines in, all the internet services are down. At the moment, what we're getting is coming from the early stages of the relief operation, in which the US has already started to help. The 3 US Coast Guards already on scene. They were helicoptering a number of people out yesterday. There was one community on Abaco, a population of about 2,000, all Haitian migrants. They lived pretty much to a man in wooden shacks. That community isn't there now. It's just flat wasteland. There's nothing.
Yeah. Well, we pray for them, a community that's gone, and you don't know where the 2,000 people are.
I'm not suggesting the death toll is going to be anywhere like that.
Yeah, right.
You know, people have been able to move around, but, you know, from what we're seeing, there is a deep, deep, silent fear that for 5, possibly read a lot more. I hope we're wrong. We'll see in the next 3 or 4 days as the main rescue operation gets into gear.
Terrible, terrible situation. And yet we see these glimmers, and they're coming from some of the same sources as they have in the past. The great chef Jose Andres and his team is there.
Well, he's not on the ground yet. You know, fingers crossed when his operation gets going towards the end of the week, he'll do as much for these islands as he did in Puerto Rico. A fantastic effort he did there. And we need more of the same. And, you know, there'll be various charities, websites where you can donate and try and help these unfortunate people.
Because what did the Bahamas do now? We know they were a British colony, became a Commonwealth, independent in the 70s. But isn't the main industry tourism? And it sounds as if...
Well, I've been here coming on 3 years now. And unfortunately for one of the islands, Grand Bahama, it was devastated by Hurricane Matthew about 3 years ago. And it has not recovered. Its population has mostly moved out. There's no industry there left. There's one giant shipyard which services the cruise ships from around the world, but its tourist industry died. The situation, the length and breadth of the Bahamas is through the hurricane season, you are literally playing a hurricane lottery. Grand Bahama, as we speak, it's probably 60 miles long. Half of it is underwater. downtown Freeport is under 3 feet of water. That's hospitals, schools, shops, hotels, everything is underwater.
Eugene Duffy, managing editor of the Tribune, the daily national newspaper in the Bahamas, the largest paper there, and reminding us the Bahamas, the length of California. Eugene, we thank you so much and wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
Well, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson faces a Brexit showdown today as Parliament reconvenes after a summer break. Lawmakers are expected to vote on a bill that would stop the United Kingdom from leaving the European Union without a deal on October 31st, which Johnson says he would do. There are already indications he may lose that vote. He's lost his one-seat majority in Parliament with the defection today of a Conservative member. Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. He's at Westminster. Rob, we can hear the protesters behind you, but set the scene for us today. How important is this day?
Oh, it's an extremely important day. I mean, I would argue that this is one of the most important weeks in British politics since 1945, since the end of the Second World War. Regular listeners will know, Jeremy, that I often say that this is the most profound political crisis Britain has experienced since the end of the war. And what's at stake right now, I think, is first of all, the future of Brexit. There'll be a vote on that a bit later. We can discuss that. It's also about Britain's constitutional arrangements, who's going to be governing the country, because there may well be a general election in the offing. And lastly, I think it's about one of the major British political parties, the Conservative Party. What is its future? Is it suddenly going to become a sort of a right-wing pro-Brexit party, or is it going to remain a broad church? So absolutely everything that you can imagine is at stake here, Jeremy.
Okay, well, let's talk about what lawmakers are trying to do today. Some lawmakers, they want to make it basically impossible for the Prime Minister to crash out of the EU with no deal on October 31st.
Yes, essentially a coalition. It's been called a sort of rebel alliance likened to Star Wars. That's a bit fanciful in my view, but there you are. A rebel alliance of opposition MPs and some from the governing Conservative Party who essentially want to pass a law saying, look, if the UK government hasn't reached an agreement with the European Union about an orderly Brexit by 19th of October, we would delay Brexit until the end of January of 2020, until next year. Now, it seems most likely that they will win this vote when it comes. But then we get to the next big question that I mentioned is, okay, well, what happens next? Now, Boris Johnson has said he will not, in any circumstances, ask for the European Union for a delay to Brexit, and is therefore saying what I would want is a snap general election. And then the question would become, well, is he really serious about that? And would opposition parties say, right, brilliant, we'll see you there?
Well, and there's a question about that, too. I've been watching over the weekend that Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, has sort of been saying, yeah, okay, let's have an election. But some other people in the Labour Party say, no, we're going to fall into Boris Johnson's trap if we say yes to a general election.
Yes, that's right, for a couple of reasons. So, yes, the Labour Party wants an election, but some are rather worried that Boris Johnson could say, OK, we'll have an election on, let's say, October the 14th is the date that's been mentioned, but that he then changes the date until just after Brexit. So Brexit would actually happen during an election campaign, and the Labour Party doesn't want that at all. And of course, some Labour politicians have a different problem, and that problem is Jeremy Corbyn. And that is that they are rather worried that if there was an election now, the Labour Party would lose it, because Mr. Corbyn is as polarising a figure as Boris Johnson, and that they are a long, long way behind in the opinion polls.
And Rob, a lot has to happen just this week, because Parliament is about to be suspended by the order of the Queen on the request of Boris Johnson.
Yes, absolutely. That's the sort of there are two reasons for the sort of sense of urgency. Number one, that Parliament is about to be suspended for the party conferences, and obviously because the government wants to avoid scrutiny over Brexit, and because, of course, the looming deadline of Britain leaving on the European Union on the 31st of October. And it's worth reminding everybody that, look, if nothing else happens, the default position is that Britain leaves the European Union at the end of October with or without a deal. I throw something else in to help everybody understand what on earth is going on. You need to know, Jeremy, that the people who now run the government, they either actually believe in Brexit, or they are politicians who think that their very survival depends on Brexit being delivered. Whether or not it has sort of bad economic shocks, I'll leave everybody to guess which politicians fall into which category. But these people are deadly, deadly serious about Brexit. And of course, there are another group of politicians who are deadly, deadly serious about stopping a no deal. And if you were to ask me, well, how does all this fall out? Well, my prediction would be, I think MPs will succeed today in beginning the process of trying to rule out a no-deal Brexit on October the 31st. But what will happen in terms of the showdown over an election, I simply don't know. And so I just urge people to keep listening to you and to us.
And to you and me listening to you. That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, at Westminster in London. Rob, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
There's a hearing in a Texas courtroom tomorrow in a case accusing IBM of age discrimination, laying off older workers simply because of their age, one of a number of similar cases against the IT company. Last year, ProPublica and Mother Jones did a deep report concluding that IBM has laid off more than 20,000 workers over 40. That's about 60% of the company's job cuts. And the reports cited damning quotes from the company's consulting arms that called older workers gray hairs and old heads. In one lawsuit against IBM, the plaintiffs said company researchers called baby boomers uncollaborative, technologically unsophisticated. And the plaintiffs claimed that they were shown the door in droves. Peter Goslin was one of the reporters on that story. He's a contributing reporter at ProPublica. Peter, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And people might be saying right now, wait a second, isn't that against the law? So let's start there. Isn't that against the law? Over 50 years ago, Congress passed the Age Discrimination Employment Act, except for a few exceptions like physical qualifications. You can't discriminate based on age. But what, it's hard to prove?
It's certainly hard to prove. I think the way you should think about this in terms of the law is that any normal person reading about these, what's happened to many of the people I've written about, would say that's age discrimination. And if the law doesn't make it illegal, then that's on the law. Mm-hmm. The law has been gutted over the last 25 years, and so it's well nigh impossible to prove age discrimination now.
Well, some of the ProPublica's findings that you were behind about IBM, you say IBM denied older workers information the law says they need in order to decide whether they've been victims of age bias, required them to sign right away, whether they wanted to go to court, targeted people for layoffs and firings with techniques that tilted against older workers even when the company rated them high performers. The money saved from the departures went to hiring young replacements. What were some of the other things that you found in your research that IBM did?
Well, I think that the big finding here is that when you start trying to figure out how many people are affected, you got to look closely at, was that retirement really voluntary and knowing, which is what the law requires retirements to be, or was it forced on them?
Well, how could it be forced? Tell us how it couldn't be a voluntary.
Well, it's pretty simple. IBM told people who were 55 and older, many of their older workers who they decided to lay off, that they were retiring. And many of these people, many of the people we talked to said, no, I'm not retiring. You're laying me off. And IBM said, no, you're retiring. Hmm. Now, that counts for something because, among other things, if you're retiring, you don't get unemployment benefits. So people fought this, but not successfully.
Well, we'll get to more of the cases you cite, but you just said something important. We're not talking about the elderly here. We're talking about people over 40, over 50.
That's right. I think one of the reasons this is important is that people over 40 and 50, but younger than, for example, my age, late 60s, in effect are stranded. We don't have a lot of social safety nets for people who get laid off when they're 50 years old. And many of these people end up being out of work for extremely long times And many of them eat through a lot of the retirement savings, the very things that we're expected to have for when we do get to be 65. So they're kind of stranded in the middle, and right. It makes a mess of people's financial lives and their personal lives, too.
Well, and also, if you're 30, let's say, or 40, and you're listening to this and thinking, well, that's not me, well, it sort of is in 10 years. So we want to lay the groundwork here. And go to the case in Austin. What are the allegations in that case against IBM?
The allegations there, this is a case in the Federal District Court in Austin, a top-level salesperson for one of IBM's products was told he was resigning preparatory to retirement. And he has said nothing of the sort, that he was laid off. And the hearing tomorrow is about whether or not the IBM CEO, Ginni Rometty, can be deposed on this subject.
Yeah. You cite in your political reporting many of IBM's own words from confidential documents. And one, for instance, talks about the company having a strategy to correct seniority mix, meaning they wanted more millennials. They had an active campaign to get millennials. Just taking IBM's position for a moment, you know, if a company feels that we are a technology company and this is a time of changing technology, we want younger people in who are more comfortable with new technology. What is wrong with that?
Well, let's try two things. One is this issue of being comfortable with technology. There are lots of images that the young are better at technology. And they may be about certain kinds of technology, and they're not about others. So there is we have to watch assumptions about technological capabilities. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we showed in the story is that people who IBM rated as very competent technologically and in doing their jobs were not protected at all from layoff. The fact of their competence and IBM's own labeling of them as competent wasn't any protection.
I'm going to also add that one of your findings was that older employees who were being laid off and told that their skills were out of date were then almost immediately brought back as contract workers for lower pay.
Right. That's right. And look, the other thing I just say about this is there are ways to change your workforce. They may be a little slower than mass layoff, but they're fairer. And as my co-author, Ariana Tobin, said in another context, here's the thing about age. It happens to all of us. And so that the person who's 30 or 35 and saying, hey, that's not me, that, as you said before, yeah, it's not you now, but it is you in 10 years or 5 years. So you should be interested in fairness here because it's going to come back to bite you if you're not.
What does IBM say about these accusations?
They say they're very proud of their record of diversity and inclusion. And in fact, IBM has a long history, particularly on race, of being liberal and being progressive. What's amazing about this is that if you look at it, the one thing that's left out is age. And look, Robin, can I just say one other thing about this? You could think that IBM was a one-off. Mm-hmm. But one of the other projects we tackled was to ask the question, so is IBM a one-off or is this widespread? And there's really strong evidence that age discrimination, dumping out 50-year-olders and older, is very widespread in the American labor market today.
And companies may be saying it's because they want fresher thinking. They want more and more. They may be saying more technologically adept people. But what about money?
Yes. Look, the critique against older people goes something like this. We cost more because of health care and we're cognitively diminished. There's something to the fact that people cost more because of health care. By the way, so do women in their 30s who are having children. And we wouldn't want a policy that says if you get pregnant, you get dumped. And as for cognitive diminishment, I just think we're working with very, very old notions of what cognitive ability is. We're living something like 30 years longer than we were a generation or two generations ago. Mm-hmm. And we are living healthy for 30 years longer. And so the critique is old.
Yeah. This is personal for you. You were laid off a few years back. It was a startup. Just, you know, your personal understanding of what happens.
Well, look, this is it is personal to me. I was laid off. I'm a single father of twins, and I was laid off in the very week they started college. And I thought I'd be out for a couple of weeks, a couple of months. I was out 15 months, which did nothing pretty to our finances. The perspective of being both older and laid off and having kids who are 22 and just starting out in the labor market and facing a world, a decade of internships and one-year contract gigs, is that you get a perspective of what's happening at both ends of the age spectrum in this United States labor market. And what you're watching is a fraying of the employer-employee relationship, which we've counted on to keep this society together, certainly during the post-war period.
Well, just real brief, Peter Goslin, I mean, is this a time that has passed? I mean, one of the things you write about in ProPublica is all the IBMers who said to you, "This we were in for life. This is what we thought." But is that a delusion now? I mean, that's just not the way the workforce works anymore.
It's not the way the workforce works right now. As a society, we have to ask if we want to have this other, different way of working where it is all transactional, it is all temporary, it's all side hustles. And I think that the answer is if we really imagined what it would be like to have that kind of world, we wouldn't want that kind of world. And we couldn't afford that kind of world because one of the things it means is that you can't depend on the employer, so you're going to have to depend on government programs to give people the tide me overs to get between one gig and the next gig. And I don't think we're ready to do that.
Well, you remind us of the other thing that happens when, again, we're not talking about the elderly, when 40, 50-year-olds are laid off. That's exactly when they are putting kids through college and exactly when they need that income the most.
And exactly when they're saving for what they're now told is their responsibility, which is to finance their own retirements and finance retirements that are much longer because we're living longer.
Yeah.
So I think one of the most tragic things we found in this story is that people just went zooming through their retirement savings to just try to keep the kids in college and them with food and a roof over their head.
That's Peter Goslin, contributing reporter at ProPublica, senior fellow at Hunter College's Brookdale Center on Aging. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rob.
And we asked IBM for a statement. They told us IBM makes its employment decisions based on skills, not age, and invests in skills and retraining to make all of us successful in this new era of technology. So, thoughts. Have you seen age discrimination firsthand? Maybe illegal, but do you think it's fair?
In February 2017, the American Meteor Society got hundreds of reports from people across Illinois and Wisconsin of a green streak blazing across the sky. It was a meteorite careening into Lake Michigan. And ever since, scientists have been looking for its remains in the bottom of the lake. One of them is Mark Hammergren, an astronomer at Chicago's Adler Planetarium and chief scientist on the Aquarius Project, a mission to find this meteorite. Mark, why are you looking for this meteorite in particular?
Well, meteorites, number one, in general, are scientifically interesting. They contain remnants of the formation of our solar system. We can't get that information anywhere else. So, in general, they're interesting. This one, in particular, we have video out of evidence from several different angles, which allowed me to reconstruct the orbit of this meteorite. That's only been done for a couple dozen meteorites.
Do you have any sense of how big it would be if you were to find it?
Well, the pieces are probably very small, and larger pieces, maybe the size of a fist, will be scattered few and far between. So we're really focusing on finding the smaller pieces, pea size, maybe penny size.
In the bottom of Lake Michigan?
In the bottom of Lake Michigan, 200 feet down.
How in the world do you even think about doing that?
Well, at first we thought maybe we could send down a remotely operated vehicle, you know, something with cameras and go hunt around. But, you know, running through the numbers, even the small pieces are going to be scattered very far apart. So that didn't sound like a good option. And then we just kind of started brainstorming and thought, well, maybe we could send down a magnetic sled. The vast majority of meteorites contain little bits of iron, and so they respond to magnets. So that's how the idea of the Aquarius Project meteorite sled was born.
What are you hoping to learn once you find it, if you find it?
Well, there are a couple different things. Number one is just studying how meteorites weather underwater and just proving the concept that this is a way to recover meteorites. The world is covered with, you know, three-quarters of its surface with oceans. So if we can find meteorites underwater, then that opens up a new realm of discovery.
And regardless of whether you find pieces of this meteorite under Lake Michigan, you also are hoping to learn a little bit about the lake, because we actually know surprisingly little about the bottom of Lake Michigan.
Yeah, that was a big surprise to us when we started this project. We figured things would be mapped out in great detail and we'd know what the bottom of the lake looked like, whether it was smooth sediments or rocky. But it turns out that was unknown, especially in this area. So when we first sent down the sled and had a camera attached to it, this was terra incognita. And we saw what really surprised us, surprised the marine biologists, was pretty much every inch of the surface or the sediments there was carpeted with mussels. And every place that we sent down the sled, we saw the same kind of thing, invasive quagga mussels.
Well, maybe they're munching on some meteorite now.
You know, they like sticking onto things. So sometimes we pick up little bits of metal, little bits of magnetic stone with mussels attached to them.
That is Mark Hammergren, who is an astronomer at Chicago's Adler Planetarium and chief scientist on this Aquarius project, which is looking underneath Lake Michigan for pieces of a meteorite that went down there in 2017. Mark, good luck, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
According to recent reporting, for all the talk of Russian espionage, it's Chinese spies who are on the offensive, actively trying to recruit Americans as agents. The Chinese government has long tried to interfere in U.S. affairs, most famously in the 1996 presidential election, when operatives tried to infiltrate the Democratic National Committee with donations of laundered money. But since then, some say the U.S. has let its guard down, and Chinese tactics have changed. Since 2017, the Department of Justice has brought at least a dozen cases against Americans accused of spying for China. In May, Kevin Mallory, a former CIA officer, was sentenced to 20 years for selling China U.S. state secrets, and he was recruited on LinkedIn. Our next guest was as well, but it didn't work. Jonas Perillo Plesner is a former Danish diplomat. He's in Copenhagen. Jonas, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, you're also a fellow at the Hudson Institute, the conservative think tank, and have written a fascinating report about Chinese espionage. We'll get to that. But take us back. 2011, a woman supposedly named Grace Wu approached you on LinkedIn, as business people do. She said she was with a headhunter company in China. You do the usual back and forth with her. But then on a trip you'd already planned to Beijing, you were supposed to meet with her. When three men walk in the room, there's no Grace Wu. What did they say to you? Tell us about that.
Well, that meeting was odd and was already a couple of days leading up to the meeting a bit conspicuous. I was interested in meeting state-owned companies that was part of my research at that time on Chinese affairs. And but being cagey about who was actually then I was going to meet. And these three men did quite unusual start off the meeting by not giving business cards, which is otherwise sort of the whole ritual in Chinese meetings. So it's almost like in a Western meeting if you showed up half naked. So that was really sort of odd. And then started this long spiel about how my articles that I'd written on China were important. It was important with people who understood China really well. And then they came to a point where they're like, but we would like to sort of support your research. And I was playing a little dumb and sort of, oh, you mean my think tank where I was then affiliated, their research, because we do have sort of affiliations with, and they're like, no, it's you specifically. And I was like, oh, I can see where this is turning.
They wanted to give you money. They wanted to lure you in as you started to realize, of course you declined, but what were you realizing? What were you thinking?
Well, yeah, I was thinking that these are some things I worked with. So this was seeing it in practice and how the Chinese system sort of uses many different sort of conduits. It's actually espionage, as you mentioned in the intro, is one thing, and that should, of course, be dealt with sort of through counter-espionage. But it's also a much broader phenomenon that the Chinese tried to use LinkedIn, many other means to gain influence in the West and basically pass their messages. I didn't follow it up. So, I mean, it could have been that they wanted classical espionage. It could also have been they just wanted me to be a, so to speak, friend of China that would publish nice things about China, which is really important for China and for the Communist Party in China to sort of get positive news media stories out about China. We see it right now with Hong Kong and everything that's happening there, where Chinese state-driven media have paid ads on social media to get their version of what's happening with the democracy protest out.
Well, and as you already knew, because this is your field, you're not alone. There are thousands of attempts to contact people on LinkedIn by the Chinese or to contact Americans in person. We read of a linguist at a military base. She took a taxi to work every day. There was a very nice Chinese driver who was friendly to her, let her practice her Chinese. Then he started asking weird questions. He was later arrested as part of a Chinese spy ring in California. You say the Chinese are building these long relationships as opposed to the Russians who make quick hits. This is the so-called Chinese United Front. There are things like the Confucius Institutes. These are schools teaching language but really influencing paid articles in American media meant to look like real news but actually propaganda. And they also want to co-opt Chinese communities in other countries. And here's it's important to note that you are not talking about all Chinese. You say that the mainland Chinese have been targeting the Chinese in the U.S.
No, that's correct. I think it's really important. Well, you outlined quite well many of the sort of things where we see Chinese interference and influence operations. And, you know, some of it is out in the open. When China Daily, a state-driven newspaper, buys an ad in a U.S. newspaper, I mean, I don't think it should happen, but it's still sort of out there in the open. The problem is really when the things are also covered or of course, illegal. So when you, for example, have a Confucius Institute that's technically only supposed to be doing language education, but then you see that they gradually sort of stifle academic freedom at the broader university institution where they're embedded by trying to sort of influence whether Chinese human rights defenders, Tibetans, even a Dalai Lama could visit university. So it's these type of effects that are basically sort of more covered and where they change academic freedom, freedom of speech inside our countries. And that's also the real danger for Chinese American communities and other Chinese diaspora communities is that the Chinese Communist Party through this United Front has an effect inside their communities. For example, a Chinese American journalist whose wife was then subsequently disappeared in China and later did a sort of video on YouTube where she denounced her husband's work clearly under duress. And that's the type of things where you basically see the Chinese Communist Party using the open access there is in the U.S. and in Western society's system to exploit that.
Yeah. Well, and you say this so-called United Front has been most successful in Australia, for instance, where there are loose campaign finance laws. If you could just very, very briefly remind us what happened there.
Yeah, Australia became really sort of the poster example of China's United Front work over the whole sort of spectrum. On the political side, it basically meant that sort of Chinese front companies were funding particularly the Labour Party, but actually both sort of main parties in Australia. And when it all got sort of blown up was when an Australian senator was speaking about the South China Sea with speaking points that were clearly sort of written in Beijing and everybody else should keep out of the South China Sea and something that sounded completely off for an Australian politician to say. And then suddenly these links, including financial to him personally as well, were discovered. Mm. And that sort of started a bigger investigation in Australia into this and actually to a change of laws, both on campaign finance and the way sort of foreign agents can work inside Australia.
Yeah, well, and you point to a lot of solutions, including there being more investigations, more awareness on the part of the press in particular. We'll link people to your writing at hereandnow.org. But that said, how worried should Americans be? We hear of your own experience. Here you are, a Chinese expert. If you get, you know, roped into a meeting with the Chinese who might want to co-opt you, what chance do other people have? But on the other hand, people might say, well, the U.S. has spies as well. But then on the other hand, we're also in the middle of a trade war with China. So how would you characterize this particular moment when it comes to what you've laid out and the Chinese trying to insinuate themselves into an American politics?
Well, I think people in all sectors need to be probably much more vigilant than we have been. So, I mean, there's been a lot of look at China in a sort of prism of business is business, and this is mainly a good sort of making money opportunity. And to some extent, it was, and it still is. But increasingly, there's also the realization that the Chinese Communist Party, which has gone in a authoritarian direction over the last decade, and particularly under Xi Jinping, also uses its different means to sort of influence us in Western democracies. And that's where we have to be aware of that. So we don't have to, of course, paint suddenly all Chinese as potential spies, but we just have to be sort of slightly more vigilant so that the Chinese don't want to steal our trade secret and military secrets as well.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, that is a question. How do you keep this from turning into a slippery slope, a McCarthy-like witch hunt with the fear of the Chinese?
That's why I think you should start from the sort of civil rights approach of saying, well, there are actually Chinese Americans that are subjected, as the example I mentioned earlier, with a Chinese American journalist whose wife then had to denounce him in China. So there are people that come to the U.S. because of the protection, because of the freedom that's in the U.S. and actually realize that the Chinese Communist Party have a lot of stooges and people that are loyal to them also inside the U.S. So I think clamp down on that part and then, of course, be still open to general Chinese students and collaboration in other areas.
Yeah. As you write, the Chinese diaspora needs to be protected around the world from the mainland Communist Chinese Party that has been targeting them. Jonas Perello-Plesner, former Danish diplomat, who the Chinese attempted to recruit back in 2011. It did not work. Jonas, thanks so much for speaking to us about this.
Thank you, Robin. It was a pleasure.
One of the nice things about summer coming to a close is that it is tomato season. Mm-hmm. So here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, is here with some delicious-looking tomato dishes. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there.
And this is the kind of time of year when you can find all kinds of different tomatoes,
yeah,
and they are delicious.
There are so many tomatoes right now. My garden just keeps producing them to the point where I'm like, hey, I need a break. Mm-hmm. But I've just been roasting sauce and making soups and making sandwiches and... Let's just dive right in. Making soups.
I'm sorry. I'm busy. I'm tweeting out a picture of this so that people... Because okay. People, when they hear that at Maine Cook is here,
yes,
they just flock to the radio. So
and they
carry
can go
on.
To hearnow.org. We've got the pictures of what we're talking about here, Kathy, but you've got a tomato soup right
yeah,
here.
Yeah, this is a really lovely soup. It's a tomato and leek soup. Excuse me. And I drizzled in a basil cream. And what I did was I heated up just a tiny bit of heavy cream with lots of fresh basil because that is all being harvested right now, too. And let it steep into the cream and then strain it. So it just looks like cream, but it's got this wonderful basil flavor in it. And the soup is very straightforward. And honestly, the best thing about it is you can use all the beautiful tomatoes that are in season right now, and you can freeze this soup very successfully for months.
Okay, but one of the things I'm not seeing in this soup as opposed to my soup.
Yes.
I'm not seeing the skin floating around here.
Yes,
what'd
good
you
point.
Do?
I'll tell you what I did. This is a fussy step, but very simple. You get a pot of water boiling, and then you get a bowl of ice-cold water. You drop the tomatoes into the boiling water, count to 10, 15 seconds, maybe 30, take them out, put them right into the ice-cold water, and the ice water shocks the peel, and it kind of starts to come off on its own, and then you pull it out, and it's a great trick.
Okay.
It works really easy, and then you just chop those tomatoes, and you can use them then for sauce. But this soup specifically, no peels.
It's just
shock
it's
the
fabulous.
Peel sounds like the name of a band.
Shock the peels.
what
shock the peels, baby.
What
Ooh,
about
sorry.
This? What about this that you've got right here? It's a tomato and peach on toast.
It is. I call it a tartine. You could call it an open face sandwich. I get really a little bit blue during these times when summer is fading, but this open-faced sandwich makes me so happy. It's the end of the summer peaches and plums and tomatoes. So I took soft goat cheese, you could use a soft feta, and added thyme and rosemary and basil chopped into it. Mm. Spread it on a piece of, in this case, brioche toast, and then I put thin slices of tomato, peach, plum. And it is one of the prettiest things that you will see. Isn't
Talk about that.
Well, the colors. I mean,
what is it?
It's peaches and plums and tomatoes. And it's just the brilliant yellows and reds.
That's a regular plum?
That's a regular, but a locally grown plum.
Oh, so
sweet. It wasn't shipped across the country. And it's just dripping with juice. Mm. And it's everything that's good about this season.
Well, and it makes you really think that you're still in the summer because
exactly.
It feels like a summer dish.
I'm one of those girls that holds on to summer as long as she possibly. I'm out there swimming until it's snowing.
Well, you've got a pasta here too, which you could take this into the winter. I love tomatoes and pasta because you can do anything.
Well, this is a wonderful dish because it uses tomatoes in different ways. I have just an onslaught of cherry tomatoes right now, yellow ones, dark red ones, bright red ones. And what I do is I roast them at a very low temperature for a while until they get just softened. They don't split open, but they almost become candy-like. Mm. This is such a great technique, particularly for kids that say they don't like tomatoes because it's like eating candy. They're so sweet. And I roast it with a whole head of garlic. I squeeze the garlic out. So you have the roasted cherry tomatoes and garlic. Then you boil linguine, whatever type of pasta you like. And then I chop fresh tomatoes in as well. So you get the tomatoes in two different ways. You get the raw, juicy, fresh, and you get these sweet, bursting cherry tomatoes. And of course, there's basil and toasted pine nuts. Buttery, buttery pine
nuts. How long does it take to put this together?
Less than 30 minutes, for real. And if you wanted to do it on a weeknight and you pre-roasted the tomatoes and garlic, you can put it together in the time it takes to boil pasta.
This is one of my favorite things. You could put pesto in it. You could put goat cheese.
Totally.
Crumbles in it.
Listen to Robin. She's running away with my recipe.
As
I'm
always.
All for it. I love it.
As
improvise.
Always.
Improvise.
What do you look for, Kathy? And I know that we've talked about this before. You don't always have the best selection, especially at the supermarket, of tomatoes. You like farmers markets or your own garden.
I do.
But what do you look for when you're going to look for a perfect tomato?
Well, I look for a tomato that has a bright color, whether it's green or pink or red, but that it's not just a blush of color because usually it's not ripe. It should feel heavy in your hand. And if you're shopping for tomatoes at a supermarket this time of year, you're probably making a mistake because the farmers markets are so full of them. I also want to say my famous roasted tomato sauce, roasted puttanesca, which has anchovies and olives, go to the farmers market and ask for seconds. These are the slightly bruised tomatoes, perfect for making sauce and cheap.
And I'll say one thing the famous Julia Child once told me. Do not put tomatoes in the refrigerator.
Thank you.
It ruins their ester.
Absolutely. Julia knew. Tomatoes in the refrigerator are a no-no.
Okay, we've got all these recipes and pictures at hereandnow.org. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Guntz, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.